Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Child Road of Little Venice, W9. 3 streets southwest of Timothy Cotter, the 16-year-old killer convicted by his own mother. 2 streets west of the scattered remains of Hannah Brown. 1 street north of the suitcase stuffed with Marta Ligman's body. And a few miles downstream of the torso and legs that no one could identify. Coming soon to Murder Mile. At the back of the Grand Union Canal sits Charfield Court, a 7-story housing estate from the 1970s. Constructed of 105. Unimaginatively identical flats made of glass and concrete. It's possible that it was built as a police initiative to cut crime, by making it impossible for any burglar to recall which flat was theirs. Demolished during the 1960s slum clearances, on this spot, at the corner of Formosa Road, once stood 2 Shyland Road. A 3-story Victorian lodging house, into which a quiet, inoffensive man called Dennis moved in. Missing some much-needed love in his life, he had fallen for Kathleen, a girl with no home, no life, and what he saw was no future. But desperate to save her from a fate worse than death, what she needed saving from was him. My name is Michael, I'm your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 221, The Saviour. Few who knew him ever thought that Dennis was the type of man to commit a murder. Born in the Irish city of Cork on the 12th of October 1922, Dennis Wilfred Barrett was one of 6 siblings to 2 hard-working parents from a respectable family. Raised as Roman Catholic, although a little quiet and a little shy, he was a good boy who got on well with everyone, whether sinners or saints. Aged 8, his father died, leaving his mother a widow. And although this broken-hearted family struggled on in the grip of the Great Depression, together they got through it. As an ordinary boy, who was scruffy, a little uncouth, but undeniably loving and thoughtful, he would blossom into a tall, powerfully built Irishman, with hands like shovels, legs like ham hocks, and a heart as big as an ox, whose pale face and red cheeks were decorated with a natty little moustache. And keen to see the world and to do his mother proud, aged just 16, he enlisted in the Royal Navy. trained at the naval school in Sheerness. He suited being a sailor, as whether he was chatting to a captain or a cleaner. He always made friends with the flotsam and jetsam of the streets. Beginning his career as a boy, on the 21st of November 1939, he set sail on the Royal Navy cruiser, HMS Drake. For this boy from Cork, his new life was exciting and dangerous. And qualifying as an electrician, across his career, he rose from a lowly boy to an ordinary seaman, all the way up to a leading torpedo operator. Only like many young boys who had signed up to fight, his teenage years would take a tragic turn. In February 1940, he was transferred onto HMS Hermes, a 600-foot aircraft carrier with 566 crew. Fitted with 20 fighter aircraft, 3-inch armor, and 6 5.5-inch guns, it hunted down German blockade runners off the coast of France before progressing to the Persian and East African campaigns. But in April 1942, whilst preparing for Operation Ironclad, the British invasion of Madagascar, as HMS Hermes berthed in Trincomalee in western Sri Lanka, with repairs underway, the stores being resupplied, and their fighter aircraft assigned elsewhere on another mission, they received a warning. Spotted by an enemy scout plane, a sortie of Japanese warships was steaming their way, hell-bent on destroying them. Caught off guard, HMS Hermes was a sitting duck. But with no time to rearm its guns, its 11,000-ton bulk limited to a maximum speed of 25 knots, and its air cover of an RAF squadron of just 6 Farley Fulmer fighters being too far away, of which they would be outmanned by the impending swarm of 85 HED-3A dive bombers and 9 Mitsubishi Zero fighters. Only at sea would they stand a chance. Being left open and exposed, as this wave of firepower later headed north, destroying the Athelstan, the Hollyhock, the SS British Sergeant oil tanker, the SS Norvikan, and their escorts. By the time that the British fighters were seen overhead, HMS Hermes was sunk. Of its 566 crew, 307 men were lost. Trapped inside its steel hull, some men were ripped apart by the blast. Some burned to death as fuel ignited. Some drowned as the ship quickly sank. And on that day, the 9th of April 1942, many died a terrible death. Somehow, Dennis survived the explosion. And as he swam as hard as he could, as the sinking ship pulled many survivors under, as it sunk, taking his friends to a watery grave, this 20-year-old was left clutching to an upturned life raft, burning and bleeding in a vast expanse of oil slicks and dead bodies. Many men died a horrible death a day. But it would be worse for those who survived. As across the next 5 hours, as he swam through a sea of steam, corpses, and fiery waves, Dennis watched in horror as his pal's dissected limbs were picked up by fish. Swirling sharks sought a free feast of human flesh. And unwilling to take any prisoners, those who hadn't drowned were machine-gunned from the air. Along with many survivors, Dennis was picked up by the hospital ship Vita. Only his nightmare had just begun. With this being war, he was given no time to grieve or to get over his trauma, as being told to buck up or get out. The very next day, he was assigned to the crew of HMS Drake, a heavily armoured monitor ship. But that experience had changed Dennis. Gone was the quiet, burly man, replaced by a terrified boy, whose nights were spent gripped with sweats, terrors, and horrifying dreams of a swirling Red Sea. No longer the seaman he once was, he was bounced from HMS Drake to HMS Defiance to HMS Drake the Fourth. But by August 1973, owing to what they described as his peculiar behaviour, he was put ashore. Posted to the Mediterranean island of Sicily, Dennis wasn't there for rest and recuperation. As assigned to LST-45, a landing ship tank, with a rifle in hand, his superiors sent him from one horror to another as part of the invasion of Sicily. Codenamed Operation Husky, it was one of the most brutal land battles of World War II, into which Dennis fought a series of street battles as the walls ran red with blood. After 6 weeks, the Allies had stolen this strategically vital island from fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. But the day that Sicily was won, being physically and mentally spent, Dennis broke down. With an officer spotting his strange behaviour, Dennis was sent to B Base Psychiatric Centre at the 54th General Hospital. Described as self-absorbed and emotionally dull, when they examined him, they found two scars, where in the last 2 weeks he had attempted to stab himself in the heart. Recommended for return to the UK for further observation, Dennis was shipped back to England and admitted to Barrow Gurney Naval Hospital in Bristol, where he said he heard voices, saw visions, and his movements and thought processes were so slow that at times, doctors stated he was like a statue. Believing that he was suffering from possible schizophrenia rather than the trauma of war, deemed unfit for naval service, on the 9th of February 1944, he was discharged and given half of his military pension. Released from hospital on the 10th of March 1944, he returned to Cork and to his family. As a qualified electrician, he got his union papers, and he coped with his trauma by working regular hours and making a good living. Given his history, it's remarkable that Dennis didn't go off the rails. But then again, he was never bad or mad. He was just shy and quiet. Sometimes described as a little distant, he was never violent. He didn't have a criminal record. And apart from frequent bouts of depression, he was doing well. One of the reasons, it is said, was that he had found love. How they met was never divulged, but being the daughter of a fellow electrician, it's likely that Dennis met Elizabeth Millard, known as Bet, at one of the businesses in Cork he either worked at or for. As a small-featured, petite blonde, with a sweet smile and quirky mannerisms. Being smitten from day one, he quickly married her, and both moving to Gillingham in Kent, they married on the 2nd of January 1946. Life was good. He was married, employed, and they soon had two children, Ingrid, age 3, and Noel, age 2. And kept busy as an electrician at the Royal Victoria Docks. Soon the horrors of his past were fading. And yet the good times came to an end as Dennis's trauma crept back. In February 1946, he was sacked from the dockyard as his workmanship wasn't up to standard. A few short-term jobs followed, but he was discharged owing to bad timekeeping. And in January 1949, with their marriage in tatters as he sunk deeper into despair, his beloved Bet moved back to Cork, taking their kids. Separating amicably in June 1949, although he struggled to retain his job as a kitchen porter in London, he tried his best to pay her £3 a week as agreed, but only able to give her £1, their relationship soon soured. On the 18th of September 1949, 27-year-old Dennis moved into a small bed sitting room on the first floor of 2 Shireland Road in Maida Vale. Working nights as a kitchen porter at J. Lyons & Co. in Marble Arch, the landlady, Mrs. Herta Budstier, would say that he was quiet and kept to himself. He never made a mess. And as a devoted father who spoke lovingly of his wife, he sent what he could back to his family in Ireland. Only his shy ways and statue-like stillness not only hid his trauma, but also a deep pain in his heart. Often sat alone, as he stared at the bare walls, he began to drink. At night, when the terror returned and the sight of burning bodies haunted his dreams, he had no one to cuddle him to sleep. And as those dark thoughts forever loomed, he even told his brother Edward, "I often think of falling in front of tube trains." Dennis was done. As in his diary, he would scrawl, "Our anniversary, Bet. This is all for you." In another entry, he would leave his worldly goods to his loved ones. And in a third, he wrote, "My love is always to Bet." With nothing left, no one would come to Dennis's rescue. But it was then that he found Kathleen. Born on the 28th of September 1930 in the Hertfordshire town of Bushey, Kathleen Mary Rossum had lived with her mother Kathleen and her stepfather John since her father's death when she was only 3. Raised with her brother at 5 Bushey Hall Farm cottages, she was described as a healthy girl who was never in trouble. Since leaving school, she'd worked at a printing factory. She'd done her bit for king and country, having joined the land army. She had just started work at a biscuit factory in Watford. And although a steady girl who liked her home life but didn't go out much, on the morning of the 17th of September 1949, for no known reason whatsoever, this 19-year-old girl vanished from her home. Three weeks later, she would be dead. On Tuesday the 4th of October, Dennis met Kathleen. We know this as he wrote it in his diary. Met Kathleen. At roughly midnight, on Randolph Avenue in Maida Vale, just two streets from his lodging, the two got chatting. Whether he was looking for a prostitute is unknown. But she said that she was on the game and that her price was £1. Instantly, he liked her. As although just 19 years old, it was who she reminded him of which attracted him most. As being a small-featured, petite blonde, with a sweet smile and quirky mannerisms, he'd later tell the prison psychiatrist, "The resemblance between my wife and Kathleen was remarkable." And although Bette was out of his life, she was never out of his thoughts. That night, having had a delightful walk in Paddington Park, Dennis would admit,
"I told her I didn't have much money. She asked me if I could take her to my lodgings. I said I could. And at about 1 a.m, we got back to 2 Shireland Road. She stayed the night with me in my room, and she did not ask for me to pay her."
Maybe she forgot. Maybe she pitied him. Or maybe, being homeless, she needed a place to stay. Either way, although brief, their relationship was caring and friendly. As Kathleen saw a softness within this burly man. And within her, he saw the woman he had always loved, but could no longer be with. Dennis would state,
"We left my room about 2 p.m. on the Wednesday, and we went and had a drink. And then I took her to a chemist in Kilburn High Road to have her eye seen to."
Sporting a sore, but fading black eye, possibly at the hands of a punter who wasn't as gentle and caring as Dennis,
"I bought her an eyeshade. I then took her up Edgware Road and we had a good feed and we went to the pictures. After that we went to a couple of pubs. She told me she had to go and see a pal and I promised to meet her about midnight in a pub on the Clifton Road."
In his diary, he would write of that night,
"She went to see her friend and she never returned. Stayed out until 2 a.m. to try and find her. Impossible."
And being desperate to see her, over the next 2 days, of Thursday the 6th and Friday the 7th, he wrote just 3 words in his diary.
"Searching for her."
And nothing more. Knowing her for just 4 days, it wasn't until the 5th day that Dennis tried to save her. Ironically, from a fate worse than death. It's uncertain how many hours he waited and how many streets he searched. But on Saturday the 8th of October, he found her. We know that, as he wrote it in his diary.
"Found her, Saturday night, 9 p.m.
Being on Clifton Road, one of her usual patches.
Although she was getting off and fixing up business, she agreed to go out with me.
It was like it was before, as they strolled hand in hand through Hyde Park and went to a cafe for a cup of tea. her being a petite little thing in a bright yellow dress like a canary, and him in a dark blue suit like a cat. Their time together was only brief, but as Dennis would state,
during this time I had known Kathleen. I'd become somewhat attached to her, and I'd suggested to her that she come off the game.
She was only young, she was only little, and she had her whole life ahead of her.
I urged her to give it up,
he told the prison psychiatrist.
I thought of her future and her life as a prostitute.
Disease, alcoholism, degradation, and danger.
But you refused to.
So it's kind of ironic that, having wanted to save her from a life so shameful, at roughly 1 a.m. they returned to his lodgings and had sex. The house was quiet, and with the rules being no guests allowed, they did the dirty, silently. A short while afterwards, as they lay in his bed, the drab chintz curtains closed and the door locked, curled up together in each other's arms,
I kissed her, and then she went off to sleep. I lay there, thinking of different things. I felt pity for the girl, and I realized what would become of her if she continued her way of life. I knew I couldn't have her living with me. And then I thought of my wife.
Whether this is true, only he would know. But suddenly, his mood changed. In one retelling, they were both awake.
She didn't want to come off the game, so I thought it would be better if she was out of it altogether. I suddenly took hold of her throat with my hand, and she struggled. We fell off the bed together, and I had hold of her throat all the time, until she was dead.
In another, he awoke and found himself in a fit of anger.
The next thing I can recall, I was on the floor. I asked the girl, what were we doing? She did not answer. I cannot say for certain, but I believe my hands were at her throat. I shook her. I felt her heart and her pulse. But her face was blue. She was dead.
Asked in court,
did you intend to harm this girl?
Dennis replied,
no, I only intended to help her.
In a fit of panic,
I tried to put her in the cupboard, but couldn't.
As although she was only small, the girl didn't fit.
So I put her back on the bed and covered her up with bedclothes.
As if by making a corpse more comfortable, that maybe God would forgive him. For many hours, there she lay.
Several times, I knelt down and prayed. And when the morning came, I left the house.
In his diary, Dennis wrote,
Sunday the 9th of October, 2:30 a.m. Kathleen died.
Far from being a crazed killer, it was what happened next which best summed up Dennis. As feeling terrible, not just having taken a girl's life, but having broken the house rules.
I went downstairs and spoke to the landlady and told her I was sorry. I had broken her rules by bringing a girl into my room.
It's unlikely he had a plan of what to do, as for the next few hours, he would wander the streets in a daze. And keen not to be discovered,
I told her, I'm going out for 10 minutes to get a taxi, and then we're leaving. Don't go into the room, and don't disturb the lady as she's undressing,
which she agreed to do. By 4 p.m, although usually placid, Dennis was fit to burst with emotion. Visiting his brother Edward, he knew he had no choice but to admit the truth, stating,
I want to tell you something. I've done a girl in.
His brother didn't believe him. Who would? So giving him his diary, Dennis told him everything. At 11:30 p.m, Dennis phoned Scotland Yard, and as directed, he returned to Shireland Road. But by then it was too late, as Kathleen had already been found. As Dennis approached his lodgings, Inspector Sercombe and Chief Inspector Burkill exited.
Are you Dennis Barrett? Yes. I shan't run away. I've got a long story to tell you, and it starts with my wife.
Found at 4 p.m. by the landlady, the crime scene was remarkably ordinary. The victim's clothes were on the armchair, suggesting that she'd undressed herself. Her handbag lay undisturbed, implying that she hadn't been robbed. And a small black suitcase, full of her personal possessions, gave the impression of a lost girl, with nowhere to go. Her injuries were as equally unremarkable. An old bruise to her left eye, which Dennis insisted
I had nothing to do with.
And abrasions to her neck matching his fingers, as he had strangled her to death. Giving a full and frank statement to the detectives at Harrow Road Police Station. Knowing he had hurt so many, the last thing Dennis wrote in his diary was this.
Dear Mum, please forgive me. Dennis.
Received at Brixton Prison, Dennis was assessed by the prison psychiatrist and told a story of the life of an ordinary boy. A little shy and a little quiet, who had done his bit to serve his country and to make his mother proud, but amidst a sea of blood and fire, had witnessed some unspeakable horrors. But mostly, he spoke of the wife he had loved, had lost, and hoped that one day to rekindle his love with. Admitting to bouts of depression, but nothing more, Dennis was declared fit to stand trial. Tried at the Old Bailey on the 24th and 25th of November 1949, against their advice, he refused to allow his solicitors to use the defence of insanity, as he felt he was sane. Even though, if the unmistakable evidence were to find him guilty, that would have guaranteed he'd be sentenced to death. With Dr. Roland Hill of the West End Hospital for Nervous Diseases, stating
he was suffering from a form of schizophrenia,
the decision was no longer his. And pleading not guilty, it was ruled at the time of the murder
that by reason of a defect of reason, he was not responsible for what he'd done.
Retiring for 30 minutes, the jury returned with a verdict, and Mr. Justice Castles declared that Dennis Barrett was guilty of murder by insanity. Later detained at Broadmoor Psychiatric Prison, his fate is unknown. Dennis Barrett was a troubled man, who sought to save a girl from a fate worse than death. only having witnessed unspeakable horrors. What he needed was saving from life.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Lordy. Oh.
Hello, everyone. How are we all doing? It's been a while, isn't it? I would love to say, it's been a while. I've been away, sitting on my ass doing nothing. I've been very busy entertaining you with my daily inches. Hope you've enjoyed my daily inches. Cheeky, lovely. Let me just open a side door and let some air in, because it's not a hot day, but it's a warm day, and I would like some air. Oops, for some reason I've locked my side door. I don't know why. Let's just do this. There we go. Open up that. Nice hot day. Well, not hot day, just a warm day. Unfortunately, I've just opened the door and went like that, just as a lady was walking past. So I'm wondering whether I'm guessing that she probably thinks that I was probably saying that to her, whereas, as we all know, I only say to Eva. Obviously, that goes without saying. It's my job, it's my duty. I think I'm going to have a herbally tea. Let's have a nice herbally tea. A Taylor's of London, I believe. Drury it is. I don't know what flavour it is, but I'm going to have it. So that's all good. What has been going on? It's been a while. I went off to America to go and see my sister. That was very good. Had good time there. Very nice. It was 40 degrees plus every single effing day. So you could only do stuff up until about 12 o'clock and then you had to go indoors. Really weird being there because obviously we don't have air conditioning in this country, really. But there, it's like everywhere's air conditioned. So you'd be outside with the 40 degree heat and then you go inside, you go, oh, and it'd hit you really hard. And you go, oh, shit. And then you go back outside again and you go, oh, shit. The changes in air was really weird. Because I went to see all the locations for the assassination of JFK. That was very good. Really nice to see Dealey Plaza properly and not just photos. It's smaller than I thought, it always is, but it's only when you're really there. I think there's a lot of documentaries out there, people doing stuff and doing all these designs, but it's only when you get there that you realize how many of these theories are utter bullshit. You've got to be there, you've got to stand there, you've got to look at the positions, which is what we did. We stood in all the positions, went to the book depository, which was interesting. We found a lovely lady called Miss Pat, whose her mum ran the boarding house at Lee Harvey Oswald. stayed at before and on the day of the assassination itself. And that's where he came back to as well, which was really interesting. So we paid her for a sit down with her and have a 2-hour chat with her. That was really interesting. So that was good. What else was good? Food. All of the food. Because I'm only used to like porridge for breakfast. I was picking out and all these American breakfasts, and I was struggling. My stomach was struggling on the first day. I made the mistake of having grits. Jesus, was it grits? Yeah, it was grits. And people were going, oh, it's a delicacy, you have to try it. It was like wallpaper paste. It was absolutely disgusting, and nothing that you could put with it would improve it. Until I went, before we went to see Miss Pat, we went into this restaurant and they were like doing us, they were doing us a cold drink because it was a hot day. I'm just going to grab my tea. Bear with. Did I put my tea bag in there? Where's the tea bag in there? It's just like, looks like I've lost the dunker with it. Yeah, so we did the, we went into the place and they were like, oh, you're from England. How are you enjoying America? Because obviously you have to overpronounce every syllable. And I said, yeah, it's really interesting. I'm really enjoying this. I don't get grits. I think grits are disgusting. And I explained about the wallpaper paste. And then like a minute later, the chef came out and he went, there you go, try that. I was like, what's this? And he was like, that's grits. And instead of it being a soppy, horrible white thing, it was more like a kind of a polenta. So really, and I was like, why are they serving shit when this is delicious? I said, I could have this with every meal. This is beautiful. And he said, whether it's the grain or the oats or whatever it is for the grits, he gets it shipped in from a specific place where you're meant to get it shipped from. Everywhere else in the cheapy restaurants, they use the pre-formatted stuff, which is just white and horrible and disgusting. And there's no flavor or texture. It's disgusting. So that was interesting. Obviously, it's interesting to see flags everywhere. Lots of flags, lots of ridiculously sized flags. Like some flags that were like 100 foot high. Whereas over here, you see flags and you just think, oh, racist. So, yeah, it was really weird. Really weird. Driving along the George Bush Highway. There we go. Just interesting to go to. Interesting to experience different life. So I will be in... because I haven't had a holiday in 9 years, so that was my holiday, and I'm going to see my dad and my stepmom in about a month in France, which would be good. So that's two holidays, and I've just come back from Naples as well. I made Stag do three holidays in a year. This is amazing. What else is going on? Obviously, in May, I ruptured my eye, so we're still dealing with the aftermath of that. I've got a kind of half vision in my left now. But it's doing better. I go to see my specialist every 2 weeks. He's had me on drugs since May. I'm still on drugs for another 2 months, so the drugs till October. And then when the hole in the eye is healed and the excess water and the everything else has come out of the eye, then they can decide what to do. So doing all right. I think it turns out that when I had my month of bronchitis, the coughing from the bronchitis caused me to rupture my eye. So there you go. I'm still on my diet since May, so I'm doing good. I'm down to my last notch on my belt. I'm not flabby anymore, which is good. I'm trying to keep the weight off now, so that's a hard thing to do. And this week I've been a saviour. I found a phone on the towpath, and it was a nice iPhone, so I dried it off because it was all wet, and then I put a notice on the bench outside and said, look, I've just found an iPhone, give me a call. And someone didn't call that my number, but they called their own number, and I was in the coffee shop charging up their phone, and they were like, have you found a phone? I was like, yeah, I'm in this coffee shop, come and find me. And they did, and they were very grateful. And then the next day, one of my neighbours, his batteries on his boat went, and I fixed my generator so I could fix his batteries. So there we go. It's two people have saved this week. Who's going to save me? Hopefully Eva. A big thank you to all the patrons, subscribers. So thank you so much to everyone who subscribed. Obviously, I've been away for a little while, so there's a bit of a catch-up here. So thank you to Alison Preston, Dave Sampson, Beth Richardson, Joan Taylor, Dean Lawrence, Thomas Fowler, I hope I got that correct, Emin Ismail DeSanchez, I knew I'd get that one wrong, Heather Ketton, and Chris Wooding. So thank you, Alison, Dave, Beth, Joan, Dean, Thomas, Emin, Heather and Chris. So thank you for that, everyone. Thank you for becoming Patreon subscribers. It's very much appreciated. Lots of goodies on there. Lots of exclusive stuff that I don't share everyone ever else. You get a lot of podcasters who do Patreon exclusives and then like a day later they just release it elsewhere. I have a lot, all the crime scene photos. I do a lot of special stuff that only goes on there and will stay on there. So yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for Stuart Barstow for your very kind donation to the Murder Mile. I was going to say Keep Michael Fat campaign, but basically this money is being spent on carrots at the moment because I'm trying to keep my weight off. So thank you very much for that. Also, Paul Smith, who's a Murder Mile listener, got in touch with me and said, "Would you mind doing a little advert on Murder Mile?" And I said, "Yeah, not a problem at all." Do you know what? If you've got not big businesses, you know, fuck them. They can pay me for this. But little businesses, if you've got like a personal thing that you do and you'd kind of you just want a bit of exposure on it, yeah, just let me know. I'm happy to post a little freebie thing on here. So Paul wrote, ever wanted to own an artwork that doesn't cost the world? Like your favourite singer, movie star, or a portrait of a family member? Please visit www.adroitcreations.co.uk. That's ADROIT creations, CREATIONS, .co.uk. I'll put a link in the show notes. For hand-painted canvas arts, canvas clocks, framed artworks, at affordable prices, UK and delivery. I can barely say the word delivery. Adroit Creations. Discover excellence. So there you go. Check out Adroit Creations for your hand-painted artwork. There we go. Let's do some quiz questions, then we'll dive into some extra stuff to do with this episode. So question answers will come at the end, don't forget. And don't forget, I haven't edited this episode yet, so I might edit some of this out. I think this episode might need a couple of minutes chopped out, so there we go. Question number one: in what Irish city was Dennis born? Question number two, how many brothers and sisters did he have? Question number three, where did he get his naval training? And obviously that's training as in the Royal Navy, not his belly button. Ha ha ha, you're so funny. Question number four, what size in length was the HMS Hermes? Question number five, what was Operation Ironclad? Question number six, what age was Dennis when the HMS Hermes sunk? Question number seven, in which dockyard did he work as an electrician? Question number eight, he was a porter at what restaurant? Question number nine, on what street did Dennis and Kathleen first meet? And question number 10, what did Dennis buy her at a chemist's in Kilburn? So there we go. Let's dive into some extra stuff on this. What I'll do is, because pretty much everything at the start, I thought we've covered that kind of fully. So we'll dive into kind of the murder and the investigation. This was the whole thing that I'd written up. I've written up all the information about this, but in the end I just felt we needed to just get to the end quicker. So the motive, so his motive for murder, he told the prison psychiatrist, this was at Brixton prison, the resemblance between my wife and Kathleen is remarkable, both physically and in her mannerisms. He told the psychiatrist, I urged her to give up the game but she refused to. I thought of her life as a prostitute. So this is what he's saying is his motive as to why he killed her. He was trying to save her from a fate worse than death, as I've phrased it in here. During the time I had known Kathleen, I'd become somewhat attached to her and suggested to her that she come off the game. When we got into my room, I again spoke to her about giving up the game. And then as we lay in bed, something came over me all of a sudden and I realised I couldn't have this girl living with me, and I thought of my wife. She didn't seem to want to come off the game. He said, we were very friendly. We talked for a while. I kissed her. And then we went off to sleep. Now, with his story, his one version of his story is that they were talking and then he attacked her, and the other one is he woke up and found himself strangling her. So we don't really know what happened. As he said, the next thing I remember, I was on the floor. I asked the girl what we were doing, but she did not answer. I cannot say for absolute certain, but I believe my hands were at her throat. Getting no answer, I shook her. I felt her heart and pulse. Her face was terribly blue, and I realised she was dead. You tend to get these a lot in these stories, that people talk about crimes of passion, and then they go, oh, suddenly I found myself with my fingers around her throat, and you just go, yeah, right. I mean, I know it could be a part of the trauma thing, but another part of it could be that they just don't want to admit that they consciously murdered someone. It's kind of better to say, it just happened. I don't know what happened. I'm glad the police filed, because when you look at the press reporting on this, there's not a lot of press reporting, but there's bits. A, they get the house number wrong. In another one, they get the street name wrong. And in this one, they say her face was badly battered. She was almost recognisable. There weren't actually any bruises to her face. There were bruises around her neck where he'd constricted her, and an old one to her left eye, which is... Oh, no, we won't say that. What else is there? He said, I tried to put her in the cupboard, but I couldn't, so I put her back on the bed and covered her up with bedclothes. He tried to put... it's uncertain why he tried to put her in the cupboard. It seems kind of I think it's just panic, isn't it? It's a ridiculous thing where it's like, I need to hide or I'll put her in the cupboard. And then, as we've seen with many people before, there's that really weird thing that they do where they've murdered someone and then... they put the bedclothes over them, they put the pillow under their head, almost as if that kind of makes it better. It's very weird. So 10 a.m. in the morning, so at 7 o'clock in the morning, I took this out of the episode, 7:30 in the morning, he went down, he pushed a note under the door of the landlady, hurt her, in his handwriting, and it said, please don't disturb me until 11 o'clock. At 10 a.m., he said he stayed in the room. I went downstairs and spoke to the landlady and told her I had broken the rules by bringing a girl back into the room. I told her I was going to fetch a taxi and I would be back. I left the house and did not go back again. This evening, I rang Scotland Yard and told them where I could be found. I want to tell you I had nothing to do with Kathleen's black eye. She already had that when I met her for the first time on Tuesday. Obviously, the autopsy would confirm this. As mentioned, 3:45 p.m. The landlady, she was expecting Kathleen to have been gone after a couple of minutes. This was a couple of hours by now. So about 3:45, 4 p.m. she looked back in. The landlady said she had not moved. Mrs. DeRocca, who came in, she couldn't hear any breathing. They tried to rouse the girl, but with no joy. And when they touched her, they found that she was cold. So therefore, they called the police. Dennis went to meet his brother. His brother lived locally, but was working in a hotel on Golden Square in Soho at the time. Called his brother. They had a bit of a fractious relationship. So his brother Edward was grumbling at him for disturbing him while he was at work. Dennis said, I didn't come here for that. I want to tell you something. I've done a girl in. Edward didn't believe him. Dennis said, fine, I'll meet you tonight and I'll prove it. They parted ways, and then they later met at the Hero Pub in Maidervale, which is still there today. It's at 55 Charland Road, so not too far away from the house. I took this out of the episode because it slows it all down. They met in the pub. They had a couple of drinks. Dennis was writing in the diary, and then he said to his brother, here, keep that, and he handed over the diary, of which he'd noted meeting Kathleen and killing her, but also, that, don't forget, this is kind of his will. He's given away his personal belongings. They did go to another pub after that. They went to quite a few pubs. They went to the Prince Alfred pub at 5 Formosa Road. It's still there today, and that was just round the corner. There they met their third brother, William. Dennis admitted to William he had killed a girl. He said, "I have blued a girl." That was his exact words. William told Dennis to call the police. So they went to William's address. He was at 154 Shireland Road, so just up the road. And they both called Scotland Yard from a little phone box. PC Donald Milburn arrived at 4:07 p.m. and saw the body. She was naked and covered in bedclothes. Dr. Ritchie arrived and declared life as extinct at 4:30 p.m. He said the girl was lying naked in a divan bed on the left-hand side with her legs bent up. There was a trickle of blood coming from the left-hand side of her mouth and her left eye appeared bruised. There was bruising to the right-hand side of her neck adjacent to the windpipe. There's another bit there, but we'll dive into that in a bit. He said she had been dead for 12 to 24 hours. That was kind of an early estimate. Her clothes were found on the back of the armchair, suggesting she'd undressed herself. Her bag was found, but it yielded no information. A knife was found in the room, but this hadn't been used. Superintendent Cheryl of the fingerprint lab was called in, and obviously they found fingerprints in the room and Kathleen's handbag, which was fastened with a white tape. Fluids found. Blood group A was found, that's Kathleen's, and sperm was found inside her vagina, so they'd had sex, unprotected sex. Bedclothes were halfway up to her head. No body was exposed. The room was not in any disorder. There was some discoloured water on the floor from a bucket, but they said this was a slight spillage. This was not fully explained in the thing, and there was no signs of a kind of a struggle. So his thing of that they struggled on the floor, that may not be true. He may have just attacked her while she was asleep in bed. Autopsy conducted by Dr. Donald Tier. Death was by manual strangulation. He conducted it at 9:10 p.m. that night at Paddington Mortuary. She was lying on her left-hand side, her knees drawn up to her, her right arm folded over her chest. Rigor mortis was almost fixed and the body felt cold. He reckoned she'd been dead 12 to 16 hours. Nearer 16. Faded bruising around the left eye. That was clearly an old injury. Three abrasions on the left-hand side of her neck, 1 inch apart, so that's the hand grip, and the second, a thumb at the rear of the neck, suggesting manual strangulation, followed by crescent-shaped marks. These are the fingerprints digging in. He said a lot of pressure was used. There were two small abrasions below the hair, her hairline, suggesting she had awoken and was struggling to fight him off. So a little bit of a struggle there, but not a lot. Her tongue was bitten and her teeth were clenched. So she'd clearly woken up. He hadn't knocked her unconscious and strangled her. He strangled her and she woke up. There were pressure marks over both shoulders, suggesting he had probably held her down. All this could have been when he moved the body. So we're still not too sure about that. There was also marks on her back where he'd moved her across the floor, then into the cupboard, and then back into the bed. Slight hemorrhage into the voice box and windpipe, to be expected. No disease or natural death. Her stomach was empty. It's said that she hadn't eaten in at least a day or two. And this was one that was picked up upon. There was blood about the vagina and anus. Now, when you initially look at that in the kind of the autopsy report, you go, oh shit, did he kill her and then did he rape her while she was unconscious in bed? But the pathologist said, sorry, there's a boat going past. It's what I have to put up with when I'm recording. The boat went past earlier on. I might make it into the episode because I might put it in as something, because the sound of the engine was quite good, but I had to wait 5 minutes because it went past really slowly and had a noise. And now you hear that, my favorite noise. Little bastards hate kids. Anyway, so the blood about the anus and vagina, it looks kind of horrific when you kind of see it written that way, but the pathologist said there was no great degree of violence appeared to have been exercised. What it's most likely is that he said that the blood in the vagina was from the natural erosion at the neck of the womb, and therefore, because she was lying that way, therefore the blood kind of came out and went into the anus. There you go. You needed to know that, didn't you? And I'm sure if you're listening to this while having your breakfast, you're sitting there eating cornflakes, you're like, oh, great. Now I know about blood going into an anus. Lovely. As mentioned, he gave himself up at about 11:30 p.m. He telephoned Scotland Yard. They said they'd come and meet him outside, I think it was the post office on Shireland Road, at 11:45 p.m. He was standing there waiting. He'd already given a description of himself. So when they turned up, there was a man there, and he just went, "Are you Dennis Barrett? Barrett, yeah, I won't run away. I've got a lot big story to tell you." They took him to Harrow Road Police Station, which is literally just around the corner. He'd got his ID on him, proving who he was. They said, "We're going to make inquiries into the death of a girl found in your room at 2 Shireland Road." And he said, "I did it. Oh, yes, I admit it. If you've got time to listen to me, I've got a very long story to tell you, and it starts off with my wife." Inquest opened on Friday the 14th of October 1949 at Westminster Coroner's Court. He was there, he stood, confirmed his name, as you're meant to do. And then 23rd of December, the inquest was officially closed. And I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's everything, folks. Because the court case was pretty much, was very standard. As mentioned in the episode, you know, he didn't want to be seen as insane. But when obviously there was two psychiatrists who were there. One said he was fit to stand trial, but the other one said he was suffering some form of schizophrenia. Although it's interesting, no one seems to say, obviously, when you look at him, when you look at the fact he's suffering from night terrors, he's got mood disorder, they say he's like a statue sometimes. That's very much kind of PTSD there. But obviously they don't have a word for PTSD there. They had shell shock. But whether this was a wartime thing or a post-wartime thing, maybe they just didn't want to attribute heroics to something like PTSD. Maybe they just wanted to give it another name and just said, well, it's some kind of schizophrenia. We don't know. Or maybe he did have schizophrenia. We don't know. What a happy story. Yeah, let's do the quiz questions, and then I can go and put this really lethal, horrible stuff into my eye, which is all lovely. It draws out excess water out of the eye. Oh, it really stings. Question number one. Okay, in what Irish city was he born? Cork. Question number two. How many brothers and sisters did he have? He had five. He was one of six, so he had four brothers and one sister. Question number three, where did he get his naval training? It was at the Naval School in Sheerness. Question number four, what size in length was HMS Hermes? It was 600 feet. Question number five, what was Operation Ironclad? It was the British invasion of Madagascar. Question number six, what age was Dennis when the HMS Hermes sunk? He was 20. I think it's hard to take that on board, isn't he? But he's basically just a boy when this happens. Question number seven, in which dockyard did he work as an electrician? At the Royal Victoria Docks. Question number eight, he was a kitchen porter at what restaurant? It was J. Lyons & Co. in Marble Arch. So that's the same place where the Blackout Ripper picked up some victims. Question number nine. On what street did Dennis and Kathleen first meet? It was Randolph Avenue. And question number 10. What did Dennis buy her at a chemist's in Kilburn? For her black eye, it was, of course, an eye patch. So there we go, folks. There we go. That's me done. Hope you enjoyed... A moorhen just having a bit of a fliddy outside. So there we go. Hope you enjoy that, folks. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm not going to be back tomorrow. That'd be ridiculous. We'll be back next week with another episode. Hope you enjoyed this one. And there's lots more to come. We're going to do a run of basically one-parters, and then we end with a nice little three-parters. There's no biggies coming up, just little ones to take us up to Christmas. So have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe, be good, and thank you for listening to and supporting the show. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.